Hallo und herzlich willkommen im Etablissement, dem kleinen Theater-Podcast für die Dame, die nicht einfach nur ein Hauskleid trägt, sondern ein Mumu. Heute möchte ich aus New York berichten und zwar von einem Theatererlebnis, das mich doch sehr stark an meine eigene Arbeit in Berlin oder Arbeitsweise in Berlin erinnert hat. Also frei produziert, experimenteller, an einem vielleicht nicht ganz so etablierten Ort. In Berlin würde man dieses hier Performing Arts Center, in dem ich gewesen bin, um das Stück zu sehen, vielleicht mit den Sophiensälen vergleichen. Es ist etwas kleiner als die Sophiensäle. Irgendwo zwischen Sophiensäle und Ballhaus Ost, so von der Größe. Und es liegt auf jeden Fall Off-Broadway. Ich bin mir nicht ganz sicher, ob man es als Off-Broadway bezeichnet oder sogar noch Off-Off-Broadway. Das Ganze wurde 1993 gegründet von 4 KünstlerInnen, um einen Ort zu schaffen, wo Leute zusammenkommen können und Arbeiten präsentieren, die sich nicht richtig kategorisieren lassen oder sich so Kategorien entziehen, wie man sie natürlich so am Broadway oder auch am Off-Broadway irgendwie kennt oder die so Genregrenzen überschreiten. Und war seitdem ein Ort, an dem Leute wie Yang Jin Lee, Basil Twist, Eve Ensler, die Vagina-Monologe, ist einem vielleicht ein Begriff, in Deutschland auch produziert haben. Gesehen habe ich dort das Stück Two Sisters Find a Box of Lesbian Erotica in the Woods von 2 jungen Autorinnen, Emma Horwitz und Bailey Williams, die beide auch als Performerinnen auf der Bühne standen. Inszeniert wird das Ganze von Tara Elliott. Und reingeraten bin ich tatsächlich über diese App Todaytix, auf der man ja meist günstigere Theatertickets in großen Theaterstädten kaufen kann, meist Amerika. Für London gibt es natürlich auch. Ich bilde mir ein Australien, in Deutschland noch nicht. Klischeemäßig hätte ich natürlich gedacht, auf jeden Fall die fetten Broadway-Shows, die gibt es da auf jeden Fall immer. Aber eben ganz offenbar auch kleinere Shows in alternativen Spielstätten. Diese Venues verkaufen ihre Tickets auch über Todaytix. Und ich scroll mich eben so durch die App, scroll relativ weit nach unten, weil die großen Broadway-Shows zahlen wahrscheinlich auch mehr für die App und bringen auch mehr Geld. Die stehen natürlich ganz oben, aber ich scroll mich so kurz vors Ende und stolpere über diesen Titel Two Sisters Find a Box of Lesbian Erotica in the Woods, der mich irgendwie sehr amüsiert hat und buch mir einfach ein Ticket. Ich lese gar nicht weiter, worum es da geht. Irgendwie spricht dieser verrückte Titel mich schon so an, dass ich denke, das schaue ich mir an. Und so bin ich in diesem Theater gelandet. Also diese Todaytix-App ist tatsächlich nochmal so ein Thema. Das würde mich wirklich interessieren, da vielleicht auch ein bisschen mehr zu erfahren, wie das funktioniert, nach welchem Algorithmus die Preise da hoch und runter gesetzt werden. Es hängt immer davon ab, wie der jeweilige Abend gerade verkauft ist. Dann werden auch morgens immer nochmal so Rush-Tickets freigeschaltet, also so Tickets, die ganz besonders günstig sind. Die kosten dann sowas wie jetzt für große Broadway-Shows $45 für Sunset Boulevard oder $45 für Death Becomes Her. Und das hängt sicherlich auch ab vom Verkaufsstand des jeweiligen Abends, ob da zum Beispiel über den Tag noch mehr Rush-Tickets freigeschaltet werden. Also das ist ein ganz kompliziertes System, was ich am Ende aber natürlich trotzdem rechnen muss für die Theater. Und ich glaube, so einfach ist das nicht auf Deutschland zu übertragen, weil wir ja hier gar nicht dieses Ensuite-System haben, wo Stücke einfach monatelang durchgespielt werden, sondern in unseren Theatern wechselt das ja täglich. Ich glaube, da ist das viel schwerer zu realisieren und es ist in dem Sinne ja eben auch kein kommerzielles Theater in Deutschland. Auf jeden Fall stehen diese experimentelleren Formen auf jeden Fall ziemlich gleichberechtigt neben den großen Broadway-Shows. Zwar weiter unten, aber sie sind alle oder größtenteils auch in dieser App zu finden. Dazu kommt, dass quasi auch in diesen kleineren Off-Off-Broadway-Theatern die Shows einfach länger laufen. In Berlin funktioniert das ja so, dass ein Stück in den Sophiensälen meistens über ein längeres Wochenende, Donnerstag bis Sonntags läuft und dann erstmal wieder weg ist. Sich dann vielleicht um eine Wiederaufnahmeförderung bemüht und dann im Jahr drauf nochmal wiederkommt. Oder vielleicht sind es auch 2 Wochenenden, aber die Spielzeit ist immer sehr begrenzt. Hier ist es zum Beispiel so, dass dieses Stück von Emma und Bailey 4 Wochen am Stück läuft und eventuell dann noch eine Woche verlängert wird. Das heißt, so auch so kleinere Formate haben eine etwas längere Zeit, sich zu etablieren, Kritiken zu generieren, ein so Word of Mouth, also Mundpropaganda zu generieren. Und die sind einfach länger irgendwie in der Rotation. Die beiden Autorinnen, Emma und Bailey, stehen auch auf der Bühne. Das heißt, sie sind auch die beiden Performerinnen des Abends. Und das ganze Projekt, das ganze Stück ist hervorgegangen aus einer Recherche zu lesbischer Pornografie. Also sie sind in Frauenarchive gegangen und haben aus den unterschiedlichsten Jahrzehnten Bilder, Texte, Magazine gesammelt, zusammengetragen. Das Bühnenbild ist dementsprechend auch eine riesige Ansammlung von so Papp-Archivboxen, die alle minutiös beschriftet sind. Vibrators, Catching Gloves, When Allison Calls, One-Pot Meals, If This Wall Could Talk Too, Chords, The Clam Cruise, The Invasion of Normandy, Pushing and Pulling, Sappho, Mummy Issues, Volume 24-31, Wetsuits, Dry Suits. Also es mischt sich dort Fundstücke zu lesbischer Pornografie mit Artefakten ihrer eigenen Beziehung. Die beiden sind nämlich auch ein Paar. Das Ganze ist allerdings tatsächlich nicht so spröde, wie das jetzt womöglich klingt mit diesen Boxen, sondern ist auch geprägt von so einer großen Liebe zum Theater. Es gibt da per se so ein wenig Misstrauen gegenüber Theater als Form. Also das Stück folgt jetzt keinem klassischen Narrativ, ist kein Stück mit klassischen Dialogen, aber trotzdem vertraut so sehr auf die Mittel des Theaters. Also diese Boxen können dann zum Teil so aufklappen, da sind dann kleine Sets drin, daraus raucht es oder es steigt Nebel auf oder mehrere Boxen klappen auf und darin befindet sich auf einmal wie so eine kleine Opernbühne, in der die beiden so eine furchtbare Arie singen. Das heißt, einerseits bricht es so die Erwartung an so ein klassisches Theaterstück und andererseits ist es aber diesen Theatermitteln und diesem Theaterzauber auch ziemlich verfallen. Das fand ich irgendwie ganz spannend, so als eine Form der Dissonanz, die in so einem Projekt liegt. Und natürlich gab es, wie in jedem großen Broadway-Theater auch, nach der Vorstellung ein T-Shirt passend zur Show zu kaufen. Vor einer der nächsten Vorstellungen hatte ich dann Gelegenheit, mich mit Emma und Bailey zu unterhalten über ihre Arbeit an dem Stück, über das freie Produzieren in New York und den Zwang, immer und überall verkaufen zu müssen. Viel Spaß beim Gespräch mit Emma Horwitz und Bailey Williams.
I saw this piece and I felt very at home. So I wanted to ask, how did this happen? Like, how did you started to collaborate?
We are individually playwrights. And that is, I would say, the primary part of our practice.
Yeah.
And then when we met, we both realized that we had a lot of similarities, both in our sort of like aesthetic sensibilities and then also in our literary sensibilities. I would say that we're two playwrights that are interested in the literary qualities of theater, sort of like, yeah. What are the tensions of prose and dialogue, and how do you tell a story that is also that's meant for theater but also has elements of prose and fiction. And so when we started thinking about collaborating together, one of the first sort of things that we were thinking of is like, how do two writers work together? How do two playwrights come together to work? So that was one of the sort of like larger questions we had.
Yeah, so we started sort of collecting different materials that appealed to both of us, sort of like our own little archive, I guess, of like things that inspired us, that really ranged from many. There was Cassandra at the Wedding, which is this great book about a woman attending her twin's wedding, and the woman is sort of this self-loathing lesbian. It's a great Los Angeles book, actually.
And she's she's not really like a lesbian, but we coded her as
is.
Oh yeah.
Please, Emma, don't erase her.
you're right.
And then like a TLC reality show called Extreme Sisters, which is all about sisters who are extreme. It's a very strange show.
Never heard about it.
Yeah, and you never will. And, you know, just plays and pieces of text and movies we love. And then we were just riffing and seeing if there was anything we could both be excited by. And we stumbled upon the title somehow. That was the first thing that we came into.
Which was
Sisters Find a Box of Lesbian Erotica in the Woods.
Right. Like,
great. That's the title, and it's also the story.
Congratulations on the title, by the way, because it was really, because I saw it, I could buy the tickets at TodayTix.
Yeah.
I saw the tickets without reading the thing. I just booked the ticket.
Wow, that's amazing.
Because of the title.
We always say, if you are interested in the title, then you'll be interested in the play.
Yeah.
Yes.
It almost needs no further description.
Yeah.
Part of that is because that description was written as the log line of what we were going to write. And then at a certain point, Bailey was like, well, what if that was just the title of the play?
Yeah.
Because it says everything that we need to say.
Yeah.
And it's tricky and it is sexy and it opens itself up. It's funny.
Yes.
Which is important to both of us. We're really also both interested in humor.
Yeah.
And Yeah, we're interested.
Not very German.
We have lots of questions for you about German theater clapping culture.
Yes, we can talk about it. It's like a way of torture.
Yes. Something. Totally. Yeah. But also, it's very funny.
Torture.
We couldn't believe it. We're like, oh my God, it's another round. It was amazing.
Maybe you could make a project. It's only clap.
We've talked about it.
it's very inspired. Probably a good idea. Because you said like a tagline. Mm. Did you apply for funding for this piece?
So we applied to New Georges, which is one of the co-producers on this play. They have a residency called the Audrey Residency, and it's a year-long residency. You meet every month. They give you a certain amount of money that you can cash in anytime. So it didn't have to be during the year.
Okay.
It can be at any point in the project's life, if that's 5 years down the road or, you know, whenever. And
how much money is it? It's a very drunk question.
Yeah, it's just $1,000. And then do they give you a stipend? Did we get a stipend as well?
I don't know. I don't remember. I don't think there was a stipend.
Yeah.
I think it was right. I think we collectively got maybe $1,500.
Well, I think, yeah. And then I think that they also give you free rehearsal space, which is huge.
And that's in New York City, I would say like the big resource is giving theater artists rehearsal space subsidized or for free.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because space in the city is so expensive.
Otherwise, it just balloons the cost of your work.
The application was very simple. It was like, what are your names? What's the name of your project? What is a 2-3 sentence description of the project? Yeah, and then what are your aims of the Audrey residency?
In Germany, it's always like you have to write so much stuff in those applications that some you start rehearsing and you're only like trying to fulfill a shit you wrote 1 year ago.
Totally.
And you have to think about like, is there a message? Is there a message to this piece? Was there something you thought it before? Like, oh, this is what we want to say with the piece. Or was
we
it just doing it?
Really, I think as playwrights, very allergic to that.
Yeah.
We are really allergic to any kind of didactic messaging through theater. We both, I think, made this piece because we really believe that you can go to the theater and experience something that is strange and weird and particular and perhaps not completely linear and still have like a really intellectual and deep and moving experience.
Yeah. When we first wrote that grant, we didn't really know what the piece was. So we made up quite a bit of things that are not what the show is at all, but certainly sounded smart.
But you said like it's a play. Would you describe it as a play or a project or a...
We described it as a play for the purposes of communicating to the people that we needed to communicate to in regards to getting grants and funding and to put it in festivals or situations that it needed to be put in, because that word play is really legible to people.
Yeah.
But sometimes when I think about it, I think about it like a piece. I think of it like a piece or a project. I love that word.
Yeah, yeah. Project.
Because it felt like an ongoing project over many years. Mm-hmm. And it takes the shape of a play, but it has, you know, really the flavor of like downtown queer New York theater, which is also I would say like a genre of theater that there's legibility around that kind of theater as well.
Yes.
Because we first premiered a workshop production of this in a festival called the Exponential Festival, which is a festival that is really dedicated to experimental, weird, I don't know what to call this work. That Bailey is now one of the co-artists.
Yeah, now I am ironically running this festival. So.
Yay.
Yay.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Don't be too good at doing something in the festival. You may run it next year.
Because I found very interesting that it has like those both sides, like being very, you could feel that it's coming from a very experimental kind of place. But it's also very accessible and humorful, which is also sometimes, I don't know how your experience in Berlin theater was, like, which is also not very Berlin.
I mean, I think we both like the combination of high art, low art. Mm-hmm. You know, one of our touch points, touchstones, whatever, for this was the reality show, Extreme Sisters. But also we went to a bunch of archives and did real research about this.
It goes lesbian pornography.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Into the On Our Backs archive in Providence, Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. But I think it is part of our mutual mission that a play or a project can be very grounded, have deep intellectual grounding, but also be really delightful and fun. And in fact, should be.
And that actually is like, I think, an opening to invite more people to think more deeply. And you don't have to if you don't want to, but if you're interested in it, the bedrock and dramaturgy of this piece is really, really tightly knit. Like, yeah. I like to joke that it's like if you take away all these boxes, you'll just see like the back of the boxes looks like the same as the front. Like we made sure to make the grounding of this and the research of this really coherent, so that we knew that when we were being really silly, we were being silly clowns, plus we were doing something that we thought had some, you know, historical backing in like lesbian theater history,
yeah.
or experimental theater history in New York City, or even sort of like contemporary theater making in this city, which is, you know, always like flowers going through concrete cracks.
Yeah.
It's sort of like you can take the venues away, you can take the funding away, but this kind of work in New York really, I think, thrives. And we've been fans of it as our, you know, in our own personal lives and as playwrights.
Yeah.
And I think there's like a lot of theater that I like that uses alienation as like a tactic, but that's definitely not one of our tactics.
Yeah.
We're very much like, welcome. Like I stand at the door and say hi. You know, yeah. this should be a place where everyone feels comfortable and entertained.
I also had the feeling in the big theaters, it's like a machine. It's like I saw like what I saw on Broadway. It's like walking into a war zone. Next here, no, move over there.
Totally,
kick your ass out on the street, buy a drink.
Yeah.
Like, and all the smaller venues I've been to have been like very welcoming and very personable. Or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's the right word, but if somebody says like here, the doors are open, you can sit down, you think like, oh, is that the theater director? Who's talking to me? It's like, am I at home with somebody? And like, also at Playwrights Horizons, like the people who are doing like, check your tickets, they are so friendly.
It's just such it's a punishing industry financially.
Yeah.
And so if you're involved in it, you better be having some fun. To make a life in the theater in this way is nearly impossible. And so the folks that are devoting themselves really, I think, do treat it in a lot of ways is like devotional. It is like, you know, come into my home. We're about to do some kind of communal activity together. I mean, I think that finances really affect the way that people can hold a space and what kinds of, I guess, vibe, for lack of a better word.
But is this like accessibility and this like humor and this like embracing people also part of selling? We have to be friendly. We have to be funny.
Mm-hmm.
We have to be humorous or something to engage the audience, mm-hmm. to come back and buy another ticket. Maybe that's...
Yeah, in some ways, I guess it could be construed as that. But I also think, you know, we're in this for the long haul.
Yeah.
And I've mm-hmm. been building my personal audience for many years. Mm-hmm. And I do believe it's sort of an act of trust to come see a show. And I think the reason why we've had such great audiences is not only because the title has a certain promise, but because there's a certain promise associated with coming to see a show by one of us.
As our individual playwright selves, or I think we're both known for like quite funny work.
Mm-hmm.
And so our audiences already have that understanding that they're walking into something that is going to have some kind of humor at the center of it, or sort of like comedy, treating comedy as like an important
feature of the...
Yeah.
Right, exactly. And I also think, you know, we said this, you know, time and time again to each other, but we think of theater as an act of hospitality and as an art of hospitality, so that the show doesn't just begin and end when the lights go up and down, that the moment that you enter the theater, the moment that you come into our world, it is where we've invited you over for a dinner party and we're going to do some really great stuff with these great lights and sound and set, but that it really is a sense of hospitality and a sense of wanting to have like real exchange with people, so that, you know, in, you know, however many years when we do another piece, we hope that the people that came to see this piece will come see the next piece, regardless of what the title is or what it's about, because they know what we're interested in serving both inside of the show itself and in the experience more
and
broadly.
How important was it for you that it's explicitly like lesbian story? Because seeing Broadway, it's so gay.
Yeah. Which we love.
We support.
Yes.
But it's very gay.
Yeah.
Not a lot of lesbians around.
No,
Broadway.
Not a lot of lesbians.
Yes, and even like the straight plays are very gay.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, part of like the petty reason why we collaborated was we noticed that in a lot of naturalistic, realistic plays that are happening right now, there's one lesbian couple in each of them, and they just hate each other. They just absolutely can't stand each other. And we're like, we hate that all of this lesbian representation is coming from straight playwrights who are writing these hateful lesbian
and
characters.
Are like, were there only to add them into the cast?
Yeah.
It clearly could have been like a straight couple.
It could have been anybody.
Yeah. And I think, you know, also we were interested in riffing on and building from the legacy of lesbian theater in New York City that came out of Wow Cafe in the 80s.
Yeah.
So we're thinking about, you know, we've got a box dedicated to our Split Bridges folks over here, or and then, you know, our Five Lesbian Brothers box and
Carmelita
Tropicana over there. And so we were thinking about what the word lesbian meant and what it meant to us as, you know, we grew up in the 90s and early 2000s. That was not a word that anybody wanted to be associated with. And we were interested in having the word lesbian in the title to be explicit and to say lesbians can be funny, lesbians can be sexy.
Yeah.
And also, like, it's a term that we don't get to hear a lot in theater. And when we do hear it, it's often about a couple in a play that fucking hate each other.
Yeah.
So we were like, what could we do a radical thing where the lesbians liked each other and they were having fun with each other?
Yeah.
Because that we just so rarely see that.
Yeah. And I mean, also just putting lesbian in the title is a great way to keep everyone out who doesn't want to see lesbian theater. It's a great way to wink at all the lesbians to say, here's the thing.
Yeah.
Here's the one lesbian show this year.
As I also realized that a lot of downtown stuff, for example, I interviewed Charles Bush.
Oh, yeah.
And I found it so fascinating that he did this like drag shows, this crazy gay, queer, whatever stuff. And as soon as he's on Broadway, the thing is called The Tale of the Elegist's Wife, where you think like, it's probably a great play, but suddenly you have to code everything into this straight matrix.
Totally.
Like even Stephen Sondheim, who was probably like the biggest leather daddy, I don't know, all around. And you always have those arguing straight couples, divorce.
Well, company doesn't make sense unless he's gay. Actually.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Right.
That's
right. They did, you know, like the last company that was on Broadway where a woman was playing.
Oh, they put a woman in. Yeah, it did not work.
The central character. But then there was a gay couple that was playing. It was these configurations that
erased like the fundamental queerness of what he was doing.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think we're always interested in, like, we already have to read into culture so much to get our rocks off.
Yeah.
Might as well make something explicit so that people can really feel like invited to do a different kind of reading, like a different kind of like queer interpretation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I ask you something? You can say it's a stupid question. Could you describe American theater to me?
Oh my gosh.
Oh my gosh. I love that question. That's crazy.
I mean, could be totally cliche. You know, if I say like German theater is like heady, director driven, you don't understand a word. There's chickens on stage where there are no chickens. Textbook. Like, so what is American theater like?
You're about to get in so much trouble for what we're about to
say. Yeah, be careful. Because also...
You won't be canceled.
Yeah. I would say that American theater is very anxious about money, about what its role is in society, about what it's saying, and about whether it should exist or not, frankly. I think it's running scared in lots of ways.
I think that thing that you just said about what it wants to be to society is a really, really interesting question that has a lot of really frustrating results. So, for example, when we were saying we didn't want to pre-producing theater that was didactic, that was telling people what it was, that was teaching people, I think a lot of theater right now is being used to teach and not be...
Even in America?
Yes, certainly.
I didn't have the feeling. Okay, interesting.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, but then also, you know, there's a difference between theater that happens across this gigantic, gigantic country.
Yeah.
So you've got, you know, you've got theater in New York City like this. You've got theater in LA that's being made by people that work across different kinds of mediums. You've got theater that's happening...
Sort of like the nonprofit web of theaters across America that sort of do the same general scope of plays, I would say.
And those nonprofit theaters, you know, the nonprofit theater model is collapsing in this new economic era. And so I think those theaters are asking, if we don't have a subscription model, so we don't have these people that will buy a packet of tickets to see anything, no matter what
we
do.
So we don't have them. And if we don't have government funding,
what do we do? And do we only do Shakespeare so that we can invite local schools to come see it?
Yeah.
And there's an addiction to Shakespeare in this country as like the, you know, the spinach of your theater diet.
Yeah.
A little bit, I think, more so with Chekhov. It feels like there's a lot of Chekhov right now.
Chekhov.
And also we're a celebrity obsessed culture.
Yes.
And so
you probably
could have noticed that. Yes.
Yes.
And I would say maybe more than anything,
and
my
that has always
is,
been there, but yeah. Now it is like heightened. Like
it's getting
they're doing off Broadway now, which is crazy. They were right. Never a part of off Broadway before.
Right? What are they doing off Broadway?
I don't know.
They are taking our jobs.
They are taking. but really, we're hearing stories from like the management agent sort of class, I guess, being like, like these actors are going to their agents and managers and being like, I want to do a play. Find me a play. And then there's this mad scramble to be like, what about this play? And so that's how lots of plays are being chosen by now to find a vehicle for a celebrity.
Yeah. But what do you love about American theater?
I love downtown theater. I love New York theater. I love that it's a bunch of weirdos. It's a bunch of people who are incredibly intelligent, who have varied sensibilities, who make these little micro communities of actors and designers and people that can really reassemble in so many different configurations, riffing on everything that's come before. Like, I just really love the scene here in so many ways.
Yeah. And then I think, you know, in my life as a playwright traveling to other parts of the country, something that's been profound for me as like an American theater maker is meeting other people in various parts of this country that love this form and that are protecting this form. And if not necessarily pushing this form into its next iteration, then making sure that people have access to experiencing theater. And that is something that I think, you know, given the large, large swaths of different kinds of, you know, geographies in this country, it really moves me to know that in every state in this country, there are people that are making theater and putting on theater and thinking about theater. And so if you, we're in this very particular kind of like a theater making world.
And moment maybe right now, because also politically, like everything is a little bit like, I came over here and I was like, what a moment.
Oh my goodness. I was going to say.
But you know, I think of theater as like an art of resilience as well, like hospitality and resilience.
Yeah.
I think like theater really, I hope, teaches, teaches is the word I don't want to use, but I think that theater offers people the ability to unbecome themselves, to be different with other people, to experience the world with different eyes and different receptors. And I'm hopeful that the more people can experience theater going can retune themselves to difference and to things that are uncomfortable. And I, you know, in this moment in America, it's like this phobia of difference, I think, is really, really toxic. It's really, really toxic. And I remain hopeful. And it's scary. A scary moment.
I can imagine. You wanted to ask me something about German theater? What did you see in Berlin?
Oh, okay. So we did see a musical. What was it?
Oh, my God.
It was Yael Ronan.
Yeah.
We saw a musical, but it was unlike any musical we have ever seen before.
Yes.
We were like, oh my God, it's so sad.
It was really sad.
And then...
Which one was it? Like the Schaubühne?
Which...
what was it called?
Which he developed during the attacks.
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah. So we were sitting there. We were like, we're going to see a musical. And then we sat down and it was so sad the whole time. It was just relentlessly sad and with like these beautiful moments. But I was reorienting the entire time. And then I was like, I don't know if I liked that very much. And then there were...
When comes the wink wink, the American wink wink.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
That's like the...
Yeah, totally. It's a little release. It's not coming. And then there were, what, five or six?
Six.
Standing ovations.
No, they weren't standing.
It was, the actors would leave and then we started
keep
to get up.
Clapping.
And then everyone keeps clapping. And then like, oh, okay, they're coming back. All right, great. And then it happened so many more times.
Our hands were raw. And at a certain point, we looked at each other and we were like, this is the show.
Yeah.
Like, this is amazing.
I mean, I felt like we were being pumped. Like,
And then we saw...
That's the release.
Yes.
You know, people are suffering in silence and then they explode.
This
is what Ancho was saying too. She says people are very cooped up and then they'll get like have a moment of road rage and just lose their minds. And
then we saw something at one of the big Maxim Gorky.
Yeah.
We saw the trial.
Yeah,
right?
Trial with Joseph Ka.
Yes.
Like a Kafka.
A Kafka adaptation.
Yeah.
Matt had some incredible costumes. Those costumes I will never forget.
I really liked the direction. I think it was so... we don't really have... We have okay directors here. We don't have directors... that with such strong visions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because the writer is very strong in this culture.
Congratulations for being playwright.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But then in some ways, you know, and I hate to say this, but in some ways I'm like, the writer is giving an offering as to what is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And we heard some horror stories from a friend of ours in Berlin who was, you know, having her play hacked to bits. But the fact that it's like, we don't want our plays hacked to bits, but it would be amazing for a director to come in with even an abstracted sense of like, what is the
big bold idea.
Yeah, big bold idea. And I think we're suffering some
big bold butch idea.
A big bold, yeah. Oh my God. If there was a director that had a big bold butch idea, yeah. I would hire them in a minute.
Yeah.
But there's also like, you know, the unfortunate siloing in America of what your roles are. And I think on this project, we were really, really lucky to have designers and a director who were willing to work with us. Like, we were knitting all together, mm-hmm. and that somebody would hold the needle, somebody would hold the yarn, and then we would switch places. And it was a very, very fluid, very collaborative process.
Were you writing also during rehearsing?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We tried to get everything locked down by the time we walked into that rehearsal room. And then it became quickly apparent that we needed to continue staying on our feet and continue. We were rewriting into previews. So we were in this preview period.
Yeah.
And we were fully rewriting scenes and redoing blocking.
Could you describe the play? What is happening on stage? Or how would you describe it?
Okay, so Two Sisters Find a Box of Lesbian Erotica in the Woods is a play written by two playwrights who also perform in the play. They are real life romantic partners and play with different variations of truth and fiction throughout this piece, which also pulls on different erotic scenarios and the collapsing of erotic scenarios into each other throughout the course of an hour and 15 minutes. The set is an enormous amount of banker's boxes that are each labeled with an element or idea or concept or feeling or impulse of lesbian culture that is very specific to the two writers. So we have created an archive of our intimate life in some ways that is both true and also a lie.
Yeah.
And we like to traffic in that in-between area. And the play functions like you're on some kind of roller coaster that is going down very, very quickly. But then you get that surge of pleasure as you feel your blood kind of like rush back and forth from your head is the hope of the play.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really funny time, we also hope. And I think we're also riding a line on humor and eroticism and trying to get you to, or trying to consider what those elements of the buildup are and not necessarily the climax.
Yeah.
There are a lot of setups in the play.
Yeah.
And there are, you know, sort of like dramaturgical reasons for why there are so many setups as opposed to climaxes. And then we end in this space of a recording between the two of these writers negotiating what it means to work and write alongside somebody. So that sort of extends out into the whole of the piece. And I think as much as this play is about lesbian eroticism and about, you know, humor, it's also, I think, very deeply about what it means for two people to work together and two people to be intimate and work together and how you create a life out of that. And, you know, it's surreal, it's delicious, it's campy, it's weird, it doesn't take itself too seriously.
They're dancing, they're singing,
no, wigs, you know, I'm a big fan of wigs. And
there's a scene change.
And there's a scene change.
There's a big scene change.
Yeah, exactly.